J'appelle la justice congolaise et la justice.
I call on Congolese justice and international justice to finally establish the International Criminal Tribunal for the Congo.
Congolese gynecological surgeon Dr. Dennis Mukwege, winner of the 2018 Nobel Peace Prize, calls for an international criminal tribunal on the Democratic Republic of Congo and receives death threats in return.
In the most expensive city in the world, we're paying to drive Uber. We are not making any money.
The California legislature passed a bill requiring corporations like Uber and Lyft to treat transit and delivery drivers as employees rather than gig workers. But the corporations are trying to overturn it.
If this opens up the way that she wants it to, Governor Reynolds, that eventually teachers will probably die, some of them. So it's very concerning, and I hope I don't have to use that obituary.
Iowa teachers, parents, and students speak out against the governor's return to school protocols.
This will be the year of the Biden Republicans. You can see the Biden campaign with John Kasich, Cindy McCain, Colin Powell, et al. Made a direct appeal to them.
And Gloria LaRiva on Democrats courting Republican voters while marginalizing progressives in their own party. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network and its affiliate stations across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The Democratic Republic of Congo's Dr. Dennis Mukwege is receiving death threats, and not for the first time. Dr. Mukwege has won the Nobel Peace Prize, the Sakharov Prize, and a long list of other human rights awards for treating women victims of sexual violence used as a weapon in the resource wars that plague Eastern Congo. He founded Panzi Hospital in Congo's South Kivu province for surgical and post-surgical treatment of victims. Dr. Mukwege is also outspoken about the root causes of the violence, first and foremost of which is Rwanda's covert war to annex Congo's Kivu provinces. Both North and South Kivu provinces are fabulously resource-rich and both border Rwanda. This is Dr. Mukwege's recent YouTube address to Congolese and the international community regarding a plan to create a, quote, independent nation of Kivu, unquote, which would be a step towards annexation by Rwanda.
Congolese men and women, national and international institutions. For several days, messages have been circulating on national media calling for the creation of a so-called Republic of Kivu. This is a meaningless project which serves neither the best interests nor the aspirations of our people. Since July 1st, the instigators of this plot have taken a new step by publishing a list of members of their so-called government on which my name has been illegally registered. First of all, I would like to express my disapproval of these acts, which involve the use of forgery and defamation, which are liable to prosecution. Next, I would like to draw the attention of our people to the trap behind this fallacious Kivu independence. Objectively, this is yet another attempt to destabilize and dismember our country. Its actors would be the same traitors who have been acting in collusion with foreign forces for over 25 years, imposing wars on our populations and causing unbearable suffering. Their aim is to see us divided and weakened to better plunder our natural resources and enslave our population. These are the same people who for 10 years have blocked the United Nations mapping report, which listed 617 serious crimes committed in the Democratic Republic of Congo between 1993 and 2003. The macabre account, unfortunately, continues until this day. Some of these acts may be considered to constitute genocide, And we must remember that there is no statute of limitations on these serious crimes. Recall that women were buried alive just because they were Congolese. Believers were burned in churches. Sick people were murdered in their hospital beds. Whole village populations were massacred. Women and men raped. These crimes and crimes against humanity cannot be forgotten or go unpunished. For 20 years, the government of our country, the African Union, and the international community have been turning a blind eye to these crimes. The list of alleged perpetrators has been redacted from the mapping report. Under pressure and at the request of certain states involved in the wars that continue to plague our country. Dear compatriots, as long as impunity continues, criminals will continue to destabilize the Democratic Republic of Congo. I call our people to vigilance and patriotism. Let us all energetically condemn this project of secession and balkanization of our country. Let us not be naive. Those who have killed and humiliated us for 25 years will never work for our benefit. I call on the national and provincial governments to urgently carry out investigations to identify these enemies of our nation. I call on the leaders of our province, the forces of civil society, and the patriotic media to express their indignation and their rejection of this plot. I call on them to sensitize our population so that it preserves the integrity of our national territory as recaptured on June 30, 1960, and that they continue to defend the Constitution and the sovereignty of our country.
Continue to defend the Constitution and the sovereignty of our country.
I call on the friendly states of the Democratic Republic of Congo, the African Union, and the international community as a whole to condemn this movement, the ulterior motive of which is to further destabilize the Kivu region, bruised by repeated wars. I call on Congolese justice and international justice to finally establish the International Criminal Tribunal for the Congo and or mixed specialized chambers to prosecute and convict the perpetrators of crimes committed in the Congo from 30 years ago to now. Like yesterday, today, and tomorrow, I will defend the Democratic Republic of Congo within its borders, acquired in 1885. I will remain committed to national unity, development, justice, and peace. May our nation live. Thank you.
Que vive notre nation. Je vous remercie.
That was Dr. Dennis Mukwege, the world-renowned gynecological surgeon who founded Panzi Hospital to treat women victims of sexual violence used as a weapon in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Dr. Mukwege refers to the UN mapping report on human rights abuse in the Democratic Republic of Congo, 1993 to 2003, whose researchers and authors concluded that the Rwandan army committed crimes that would be charged as genocide in a court of law when they attacked Hutu refugee camps in eastern Congo. Powerful figures, including Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, and Barack Obama, have honored Dr. Mukwege for his work as, quote, the man who heals women, unquote. However, they have not supported his demand for an international criminal court to indict those implicated in the UN mapping report. Gates and Clinton are both long-standing allies of Rwandan President Paul Kagame. In January, the California legislature passed Assembly Bill 5, which requires companies like Uber and Lyft to treat drivers as employees rather than gig workers. Since then, the companies have been trying to overturn it in court, and now they're trying to overturn it at the ballot box in November. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer reports.
The ongoing struggle of Uber, Lyft, and other drivers to fight for workers' compensation, Social Security, and disability has taken a major turn in California with the passage last year of Assembly Bill AB 5. It required that these transit and delivery companies treat the workers as employees. This is especially critical in the midst of the COVID pandemic for frontline workers to have PPE and protection on the job. Despite this California law, Uber and other billionaires who run these companies continue to fight the law in court. These companies have also spent over $110 million on Proposition 22 to overturn AB 5 in the upcoming November elections. On August the 20th, Uber and Lyft drivers rallied at the Uber World headquarters in San Francisco to demand that they get worker protections and benefits. Some have stopped working because of the failure of these companies to provide protection for the workers. The company threatened to shut down their companies unless their appeal was accepted by a judge. Now to the interviews.
Drivers United will never be defeated. The Drivers United will never be defeated.
My name is Alan. I'm a Lyft driver and have been for the last 3 years. And I'm excited today because we're in front of Uber headquarters, letting them know that we're a little unsettled about their reactions to AB 5 and Proposition 22.
And they're spending a lot of money on this ballot initiative.
They certainly are. The estimates are over $110 million as of this day. And the ballot initiative, as we feel, drivers, is just contrary to AB 5, which has already been approved by the state legislature. And they're actually taking our lessened earnings and using them against us.
My name is Sari Okawa. I'm here to support no on Proposition 22. Because the law passed that we are employees of Uber and Lyft, and they're just breaking the law, and they put so much money to put this ballot on November election, and it doesn't make sense. Instead of helping us and supporting us and giving us protection, they just wanted to spend that money to fight against us, and I think it's a very nasty thing to do. I have to work sometimes 7 a.m., come back home 7 p.m., not even, the average I made was 180 something, and that's divided by 12, it's lower than minimum wage, that's 11 something, and that's excluding my gas and my car rental fee, so, and I live in San Francisco. How? A lot of drivers are like that. It's like a sweatshop.
After gas and depreciation, I make somewhere in the realm of $1.50 to $2.50 per hour. Last year, I worked 65 hours a week. I take one day off a month, and I made a total of $8,800 working 65 hours per week in the most expensive area in the world. The reason that we're protesting is because we believe in the gig economy. But they do not. They believe in automation. That's what they believe in. They do not believe in a person-to-person application. They believe in a person-to-robot application, and they are taking the money from us to do that. We're paying for the robots. Most rides in San Francisco are $4. $4. It does not cost $4 to pick you up in a gasoline car and take you where you want to go in a private car in the most expensive city in the world. We're paying to drive Uber. We are not making any money.
I didn't make minimum wage. You can write off your miles, it's like the best, but you can't write off all those additional expenses like car washes and your lease on your car. And it became not worth it anymore. Yeah, we have no protection. We can't get unemployment. You know, you have to pay that additional 7.5% Social Security tax that your employer would normally pay. You have to, you know, get your health insurance outside of that. There just really are no perks at all. They make you on your taxes declare the total of gross amount from your rides, and which I don't even know how they got away with that. But yeah, I have to claim as my income what they got, what they profited. So that was, their profit was part of my income, which I found very odd, the way they worked around it. I just found that was very odd that I had to declare their profit as my income.
Beyond that, it becomes almost like a privatization of public transportation, because they're not just undermining Lyft, but they're undermining public transportation, buses, BART's train, just everything. They're riding it at a subsidized price that they're selling the metrics to investors, big data. They're basically selling the numbers of riders, the numbers of drivers, the numbers of rides provided, and whether it's done at a loss and that the driver is shouldering the lion's share of that loss, it does not matter to them because they still have their multi-billion dollar investors.
My name is Idan Alva. I've been a Lyft driver since 2014, and I'm an organizer and driver leader with Gig Workers Rising. Gig Workers Rising is an advocacy group that has been fighting for the rights and improvement of working conditions for gig app-based workers. Lyft and Uber decided to use their regular tactics, which is bullying drivers, bullying the public, and threatening to shut down the business or shutting down the business for a while just so that they can get what they want. Those companies keep providing misinformation as though there is a connection between flexibility and the status of an independent contractor or lack of flexibility as employees. These are lies. Drivers want the work to continue and they want Lyft and Uber to comply with the law, which is providing livable working conditions to their workers, minimum wage plus benefits. Nothing more, nothing less. It's not a way to get rich, it's a way to be able to exist. Lyft and Uber care more about their bottom line and about the enormous profits they made off our back so far than they do about their drivers. So they don't want to reduce even minimally their profit margins in order to comply with the law.
This has been Steve Zeltzer reporting for Pacifica.
I was born one morning when the sun didn't shine. I picked up my shovel and I walked to the mine. I loaded 16 tons of number 9 coal, and a straw boss said, "Well, bless my soul, you load 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store." I was born one morning, it was drizzling rain, fighting and trouble on my middle name. Raised in a canebrake by an old mama line, ain't no high-toned woman make me walk the line. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. A lot of men didn't, and a lot of men died. With one fist of iron and the other of steel, if the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
School has not yet started in most states, but things are ramping up in Iowa. People are organizing to educate themselves and to speak out against the controls and policies being imposed by the governor's office. Ursula Rudenberg reports from Ames, Iowa.
Remember the days of the old schoolyard? We used to laugh a lot. Oh, don't you remember that?
On July 17th, Iowa's Governor Kim Reynolds interrupted planning underway at local school boards and county health departments when she announced that school districts will be required to open schools for in-person instruction at least 50% of the time. schools or school districts will be required to get a waiver from the Department of Education if they want to temporarily transition to remote learning. School districts may only request to go to 100% online learning for 2 weeks if their counties have a 15% positive COVID-19 rate in a 2-week period and if 10% of students are absent. Iowa does not have a mandate to wear face coverings, and numbers of cases continue to spike around the state. On August 15th, the number of new coronavirus cases in a 24-hour period hit an all-time high of 832. Last week was called a week of action by Iowans for a Safer Return to Learning, a coalition of Iowa groups to raise public awareness and to send a message to Governor Reynolds. Organizing is happening mostly via Facebook, where coalition members describe themselves as education and community organizations representing thousands of concerned Iowans. Jerry Drumkrieger is a teacher in Northwest Iowa going on 7 years. He co-founded one of these organizations, Iowa Educators for a Safe Return to School.
After Governor Reynolds came out with her plan to basically not really have a plan, there's a lot of confusion and fear, and we're constantly talking and trying to figure this out. We decided to make this group just to talk amongst ourselves, and now we have like over 21,000 people from all over Iowa, teachers, parents, there's grandparents on there that are concerned about their kids. We have grandparents on there that are concerned about their kids who are teachers.
Last summer, Gary gained national attention when he published his own obituary describing a lonely and painful death by COVID-19. He has inspired other teachers around the country to send their own obituaries to their governor's office.
Essentially, what I wanted to do was get everyone's attention about if this opens up the way that she wants it to, Governor Reynolds, that eventually teachers will probably die, some of them. So it's very concerning, and I hope I don't have to use that obituary.
Daniel Gutman represents Drive for Lives, another of the groups of concerned teachers and citizens in Des Moines, Iowa, where Gutman teaches.
We decided we needed to voice our concerns and figured maybe a few of us could drive around the Capitol and express our disagreement with Governor Reynolds. We had a permitted car procession advocating for a safer return. When July 17th came around with her proclamation, our little event turned into over 1,000 people from across the state. It was really a beautiful event. It allowed teachers to find solidarity, and teachers really need to find strength with each other and our allies right now. Teachers are scared right now. I'm hearing from teachers whose buildings are so overcrowded that even with families choosing online, they're looking at teaching in a small 10 by 10 foot room with 15 students. I'm hearing about school districts requiring staff meetings with over 100 individuals prior to school starting. I'm hearing about teachers who have spouses or a loved one in high-risk categories, and they've got to make a choice whether they can do their job, fulfill their passion for what they want to do, but then also having to consider whether that passion can cause the death of a loved one. I know every year I'm going to spend a significant part of that year with various colds, viruses, and bugs. I may bring something home to a loved one. This year's a little bit different.
Last Wednesday, I woke up with a pretty bad headache. I didn't have a fever, but I had it all pretty much. I had lots of the COVID symptoms. So I called my doctor, and the doctor suggested I get a COVID test, right? And for 4 days, I had to sit in my little room down here. And I just started thinking a lot about this is what it's going to be like at school. If you wake up and you have a little bit of a fever or a running nose, every time I'm going to have to go get a COVID test, I'm going to have to be separated from my family. And the governor seems to want to think that it's okay for us, even if we're exposed, not showing symptoms, to be around kids. And I think that we have to ask ourselves, is that the moral question? I could not live with myself if, you know, I took something into school and I exposed 300 and some kids to it. It's really concerning to me. And that's why teachers are fearful, because there's just so many unknowns in the mentality that they have. Just go for it. It's scary.
Certain school districts, such as Des Moines Public, really stepped up and took the advice of public health experts. And when July 17th came around with the governor proclamation that really stripped some of that local control and threw school districts for a loop, given that there's been a complete lack of leadership at the state government, we feel that the state ceded control, and those districts that are making responsible choices need to be able to move forward and do that. So Jeremy set up a Zoom meeting. We all got together and we started to talk about how we can affect some positive change.
The Week of Action has included press conferences and connections with national advocacy groups and public officials, student-centered activities, opportunities for people to support school staff other than teachers, social media blitzes, online teach-ins on issues such as science, and regionally planned car processions called flash drives.
Teachers love to teach. We're healers. We're people that try and pass on our wisdom, but we don't want to do anything that's going to endanger the lives of anyone. That goes completely against the grain of what most of us feel in our heart.
But I'm just wondering if either of you have an analysis about why this is happening today in Iowa.
Several years ago, oversight of the Department of Education was removed from the Board of Education and given to the governor, which, as a matter of practice, I think is a big issue because it allows for the politicization of educational policy. Number two, there's been an assault on science in our country. Somehow facts and data and science has become debatable, questioned by our leaders. I think when you couple education policy has become political with science is not accepted by a significant portion of our society, that leads to trouble.
Viruses don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. We're at a crossroads here of what's acceptable. People need to realize that this is real.
That's Jerry Dumkrieger and Daniel Gutman, two teachers in Iowa who have been organizing. More information about their Week of Action and the teach-ins they have been providing can be found on Facebook under Iowans for a Safer Return to Learning. And I'm Ursula Rudenberg at KHOI Community Radio in Ames, Iowa, reporting for Pacifica Radio Network.
This is Pacifica Radio's COVID Race and Democracy. We'll be back in a minute.
If ever you think about the happiest days of your life, cast back your mind for a while and remember the time when you were a child. Don't think of things that make you sad. Just remember all the good times that you had. Do you remember only happy days full of flame? Summer holidays, or do you remember those stormy Novembers as we walked in the wind and the rain? School days were such happy days, now they seem so far away. School days were the happiest days of your life, but we never appreciate the good times we have until it's too late. I miss all the acquaintances we made, and I'd go back if I could only find a way. Though at the time they filled me with despair, we only remember what we choose to remember. When I was a schoolboy, I loved you.
Have you noticed the exponential growth in U.S. war fronts and the military budget, and how the talking heads on the news shows telling you who is the current enemy of the United States sound unbelievably similar?
China. 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 China.
China. China. China. China. China.
Putin and Russia. Russia. Moscow. Russia. Russian. Russian. Russia. The Russians.
It is not a magic trick. Those are the actions of six major corporations: National Amusements, Disney, Time Warner, Comcast, News Corp, and Sony. They are the ones who shape public opinion because they control about 90% of mass media.
Russia, Russia.
They're the adversary. They want to bring us down, the Soviet Union.
It's time to support your local community radio and let the people be free again. More information at Pacifica.org.
Dr. Michio Kaku on the latest coronavirus guidelines.
This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Well, epidemiologists are cringing at the thought that we're entering the third wave, that is September and the flu season. Now, back in 1918, there were two major waves. The first wave was when the Spanish flu virus hit, catching everybody off guard. But then a lockdown took place. Yes, even back then, people wore masks and there was a lockdown. But then come September of 1918, there was a second wave even bigger than the first wave. People let down their guard, not to mention the fact that flu season kicked in. And as a consequence, the second wave of September 1918 was even bigger than the first wave. So some people are saying, are we going to repeat history? Will we be hit by a double whammy? Think about it. Come wintertime, people are going to huddle up. They'll be huddled up in buses, subways, cars, homes. And it means that the infection rate could increase as a consequence, not to mention the fact that children and college students are going back to school, not everywhere, of course, but in many communities, and that could also increase the infection rate. And just realize now that we realize that children above the age of 10, can also spread the virus like adults. And that forces us to rethink what it takes to stop this killer virus. First of all, the CDC, well, it makes recommendations, but these recommendations are usually months behind what's happening in the laboratory. Scientists are already in the laboratory showing that the virus can spread in ways that were previously dismissed. The CDC, many scientists are now saying, not officially, but privately, they're saying that you should wear glasses. Not to mention the fact that the 6 feet distance recommended by the CDC, that may eventually change. Scientists are saying that at minimum, you should separate yourself by 6 feet. Let's do the garlic test. If you can smell the garlic on somebody's breath, you are much too close to that person. Or let's do a perfume test. By spraying perfume inside a house, you create lots of aerosols, much smaller than the droplets talked about by the CDC, and you can smell perfume halfway across the room. And so some people are saying that the 6 feet distance of social separation should be only taken as a minimum. And then what are you separating from? We now realize that the virus can be spread by breathing. Let me repeat that again. Simply by breathing, you can spread the virus. So here's another recommendation that some doctors are making, but is now not official policy. And that is, if you're going to buy something, of course, you may want to buy a thermometer, but buy an oximeter. You see, many people don't realize that their body is being deprived of oxygen because the body overcompensates by breathing harder, and you struggle along. You say, nah, I don't want to go to the hospital yet. I can still breathe. Wrong. Your oxygen levels are dropping. So by the time you go to the hospital, many times it's too late. And then they put you on a ventilator, and up to 90%, let me repeat that again, up to 90% of those individuals put on the ventilator eventually die. Now think about that for a moment. Isn't there a simple device that can tell you when to check into a hospital? And the answer is yes. It's called an oximeter, very cheap. It only costs about $50 on the internet, and it doesn't prick your finger at all. It simply snaps over your finger, painless, and in about 5 seconds, it tells you how much oxygen you have in your blood. When your oxygen levels are too low, your blood turns bluish. So simply by shining light into your finger, this object is capable of determining your oxygen content. Normally, it's between 98 to 100%. Once it starts to drop below 98%, bingo, that's when you check into a hospital, even if you can breathe, even if you think you can gut it out. No, you are losing oxygen at a rate such that when you do check yourself into a hospital, many times it's too late. And so a word to the wise. Yeah, buy a thermometer, but you may also want to buy an oxygen meter, an oximeter as well. And of course, once you're in the hospital, then there are therapeutics which actually work. Of course, they're not cures by any sense of the word, but they can reduce the death rate and reduce the number of days in the hospital. One is remdesivir, which can actually reduce the number of days in the hospital that you put on these oxygen meters, and dexamethasone, which is a cheap steroid costing only a dollar a day, which reduces the death rate almost by half. And so write these down. Remdesivir, which can reduce the amount of time that you have to be forced to get oxygen, and dexamethasone, a cheap steroid, which can actually reduce the death rate, because what kills you is not the virus at all. The virus doesn't kill you. What kills you is the fact that the body overreacts. The immune system overreacts and injects chemicals and substances into your blood, which cause organ failure, and that's why you die. So, a word to the wise. Be prepared for the third wave. If possible, buy glasses, some kind of face shield, stay away from other people, that's unnecessary, and perhaps you'll live to get a vaccination.
That was Dr. Michio Kaku, whose show Exploration airs on Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York City.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Now, Black Agenda Report poet in residence Raymond Nat Turner on President Trump's pandemic management.
The low bar boss tweet, rapid response to COVID-19. Quote, if they come for me in the morning, they will come for you in the night. Unquote. Angela Y. Davis. Line anarchists, agitators, communists, Marxists say he's going Pinochet by the bright light of day. Misdirection, distraction, no way. Only 150,000, well, maybe 20 times that, have died under enlightened leadership of low bar boss tweet. Still, we have the best tests, the most tests, by far, the best health care in the world. Cuba ain't shit. 1% is good to us, takes care of us, cradle to grave. Stab the wind with your foam fingers and chant, USA, 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 we're number one. Now, I don't know about you, but I heard Lobar, boss tweet, got camouflage cats jumping from unmarked vans, sticking swabs up nostrils, testing for COVID-19. Now, I don't know about you, but I heard Lobar, boss tweet, got camouflage cats jumping from unmarked vans, cornering citizens and tracking their contacts down. I don't know about you, but I heard Lobar, boss tweet, got camouflage cats jumping from unmarked vans, whisking folks off to empty five-star hotels for 14-day quarantines. No, I don't know about you, but I heard Lobar, boss tweet, got camouflage cats jumping from unmarked vans. Hand in hand sanitizer. Masks, gowns, gloves to beleaguered frontliners, housekeepers, nurses, docs. Now, I don't know about you, but I heard Lobar Boss Tweet got camouflage cats jumping from unmarked vans, cutting $2,000 a month checks, and handed them out to every adult desperately needing to shelter in place. Now I don't know about you, but I heard Lobar Boss Tweet got camouflaged cats jumping from unmarked vans with hammers, nails, saws, 2x4s, flattening the curb, raising roofs over heads of the unhoused. And oh, by the way, the number 150,000 times 20 is too big for their badges.
That was Raymond Nat-Turner. This is Pacifica Radio's COVID Race and Democracy. We'll be back in a minute.
Every day, corporations that own 90% of mass media give you a dose of propaganda to keep your brain filled with hate for a particular head of state.
First, basic facts. China's been ruled by a brutal authoritarian regime.
Maduro is a brutal, corrupt leader. We will continue to make the case that he should step aside.
It may be the leader of Iran, North Korea, Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, or Russia. The purpose is to keep you ready, to give your money in the lives of your sons and daughters to save the world. In the name of democracy, they loot and rob the resources of other nations.
Venezuela is one of the three countries I call the troika of tyranny. It'll make a big difference to the United States economically.
For a democracy where politicians are for sale and for the perpetuity of the mighty U.S. dollar, the time is now to put a stop to all these deadly mind games. Support your local community radio. More information at pacifica.org.
During the final evening of Pacifica Radio's coverage of the Democratic Convention last Thursday, presidential candidate Gloria LaRiva of the Party for Socialism and Liberation and the Peace and Freedom Party talked to host Margaret Prescott about the importance of having a socialist on the November ballot.
Frankly, there's not a lot of difference in the approach to, let's say, Venezuela on the part of the Democrats and the Republicans.
Yes, Joe Biden has in the past said we are going to bring democracy to Venezuela, which really means supporting the regime change efforts and even supporting Guaido beyond anything imaginable. But in addition is the issue of Israel, apartheid Israel, and its war on the Palestinian people, which the Democrats are wholeheartedly united with the Republicans on. We're all aware of that, that Pelosi and the Democrats in the Senate in 2009 January, when Gaza was being mercilessly bombed, and they were running out of weapons and missiles, Israel was, the Senate voted 100% to send more weapons to Israel. And that's the legacy of the Democrats. That's the legacy of every Democratic president, and including this, you know, terrible reactionary move that Trump has done. So there's unity among them. And the question of Venezuela is very serious. There's reports right now about the increase in the COVID virus because so many people coming back through the border, coming back through these informal roads, refusing to abide by the lockdown and the social distancing. And this is a country that's so heavily blockaded, denied medicine, and then the U.S. is boasting about the suffering. It's just horrific. Every election presidential year, it's necessary for the socialist voice to be there, because if we were not there, if we were not there this year, the Democrats and the Republicans could go on acting like there's just some minor changes needed, or that the battle is only between the two parties over who's going to have power for the next 4 years, without addressing anything for the people. We only have to look at the Democratic National Convention, where they have to show their best face. It's a very slick production we're seeing, but what you have is, in fact, bringing the unity, once again, of the Republicans, the most recalcitrant Republicans, with the Democrats, and very little voice. In fact, it has been suppressed, the voice of the progressives within the Democratic Party.
This will be the year of the Biden Republicans. You can see the Biden campaign with John Kasich, Cindy McCain, Colin Powell et al. Made a direct appeal to them. You can take Biden Republicans where they're more self-identified with the Democratic Party than the Republican Party.
That AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, got 90 seconds to nominate Bernie Sanders. And what a movement that was crushed in March by all the other Democrats. And how when the pandemic broke out in mid-March in this country with the lockdown, partial lockdown, that he was silenced on the idea of health care for all, Medicare for all. And now you have Biden saying, oh, no, we don't need that. What? When 50 million people lost their jobs and have no health care, when 40 million others have no health care and millions others can't pay for the expensive health care they have, the crisis is a pandemic, but it's exacerbated and made far worse by capitalism. And socialists must be there. If we weren't, we would be leaving it up to the myths and lies that we hear every 4 years. Our campaign has helped lead caravans across the country demanding cancel the rent, which has actually gotten a lot of news coverage in the more than 40 cities that we've had the cancel the rent caravan. It's something everybody understands, that 50 million people right now are being subjected to possible evictions. If we don't come out of this crisis with the right to housing for those who cannot pay and those who are homeless, because everybody could be housed today, then we're going to see the pauperization of the working class at a level we have never seen before, permanent pauperization. And it doesn't have to be that way. Today, Apple announced that they have made $2 trillion during the pandemic. This is beyond obscene wealth. And Amazon is raking in hundreds of billions of dollars, along with Whole Foods and Tyson and Smithfield, the food providers, while those workers in the meatpacking places are dying of the COVID virus and getting sick. The farm workers in the fields who don't even have rights in this country, providing food for the whole country, and they don't even have the right to hazard pay. And so this is a crisis in which what we're saying in the campaign is that if you look at our history, the very recent history, only the struggle has made any change forward, whether it was Black Lives Matter and the dismantling of some of the racist monuments and systemic racism that we're seeing, fighting back against police brutality. The Fight for 15, I often ask people, what politician started the campaign for Fight for 15? Who first raised in Congress the idea of the minimum wage of $15 and made it a movement? People go, I don't know. Nobody. It was the low-wage workers and the unions that started it.
Gloria, there is some breaking news because your VP candidate was Leonard Peltier, but apparently he's having some health and other issues. Just tell our listeners what is happening with Leonard Peltier now.
Yes, thank you. He was so proud to be our candidate. He was very excited. He felt he was helping build a Native American voting bloc. It's very serious, so he said he had to withdraw. But also he has some legal matters that he's hoping can give him freedom. There's always the hope. And so we were there was no choice. I mean, we it was not even a question. We said, we need to make sure that you get healthy and that you find a way to be free. And so it was a very sad but a very understandable withdrawal. And he sent a very sweet and wonderful statement saying, it's not because I don't believe in this, because he does.
That was presidential candidate Gloria LaRiva. And now here are Black Agenda Report editors Margaret Kimberly and Danny Heifong on Democrats.
There seems to be this propaganda campaign to convince people that Trump is going to lose. And Democrats are doing everything except what you're supposed to do in a campaign, namely mobilize your voters. And you mobilize people, the primary way is to give them what they want, give them something that they need and want. Biden is adamant there'll be no Medicare for all.
The Biden proposal, you'd be covered for all of this. The fact of the matter is that everyone would be covered under taking Obamacare, restoring the cuts that have been made.
So all of the things that people need right now, especially in this year of the COVID pandemic and so much dislocation, the job losses, the inadequate stimulus bills, the fact that the additional $600 that unemployed people were getting is about to run out, the fact that there are states that people still can't seem to access their benefits. He's not offered anything that addresses any of those issues. People are desperate. And that's the first way you reach people. You address some need they have. But he's committed to not doing that. And that's why they chose him. That's why they rigged the primaries in his favor. It's why Obama chose him to get that more conservative Democrat, although he was plenty conservative himself. In 2016, and I will never forget 2016, and I've often thought about what I missed because I also thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. I did not know that she had made a mess of the voter outreach. Basically, she didn't bother with it.
For every blue-collar Democrat we will lose in Western PA, we will pick up two, three moderate Republicans in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And you can repeat that in Ohio and Illinois and Wisconsin.
The degree of voter suppression, for example, Wisconsin, one of those states that flipped, we're told. Wisconsin enacted a voter ID law. Thousands of people couldn't vote. He won this, he's 20,000 votes, I think. People either could not vote or thought they could not vote and didn't bother. They made it very difficult for college students to register. So all these voters that Democratic presidential candidates got in Wisconsin were just taken off the rolls. The cross-check, the vote purges, vote purging schemes. My home state of place where I was born, Ohio, you have to vote in a federal election, and that means Congress. That means every 2 years. If you didn't vote in 2018, you cannot vote in 2020 unless you re-register. So those are the kinds of things that Republicans do that Democrats never say anything about. What we should learn from Al Gore's loss, the theft of the 2000 election, the theft in 2016. When they say someone's ahead in the polls, assuming the polls are accurate at all in the first place, what is the polling in Pennsylvania? What's the polling in Michigan? What is it in Wisconsin? What is the voter outreach like? What is the voter suppression like? Those numbers are meaningless. They are absolutely meaningless. And then you have the problem of Biden himself. He was never very bright. He was always dumb. He was always rather odd. But now he clearly has some sort of health problem, a cognitive problem. He doesn't know where he is. He blurts out. A couple of days ago, a black reporter was talking to him and asked him about this cognitive test.
Please clarify specifically, have you taken a cognitive
test? No, I haven't taken a test. Why the hell would I take a test? Come on, man. That's like saying you, before you got in this program, if you take a test where you're taking cocaine or not, what do you think, huh? Are you a junkie?
What do you say?
Are you a junkie? He screamed,
yes,
I think.
Yes. Are you a junkie? Then it was Latino voters are very diverse, and unlike black people.
Yes. And by the way, what you all know, but most people don't know, unlike the African-American community, with notable exceptions, the Latino community is an incredibly diverse community with incredibly different attitudes about different things. You go to Florida, you find a very different attitude about immigration in certain places than you do when you're in Arizona. So it's a very different, a very diverse community.
So then they get this right-wing Latina to be the Latino voter outreach person. So all of these things add up to him losing. And all the things they keep saying about Trump, Trump will quit. Trump can't win. And it's a substitute for policy. Yep. You get people out when you offer them something. It's not enough to say people don't like Trump. There are people who don't like Trump who still are not motivated voters. These stories about him quitting, it's a lie, and it's meant to try to drag Biden over the finish line, and I don't think it's going to work.
Thanks to Margaret Kimberly and Danny Haifong for that material from their weekly YouTube podcast, The Left Lens. That concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev and myself, Ann Garrison. The show's executive producers are Akua Holt, Steve Seltzer, and Polina Vasiliev. Verna Avery Brown is our executive consultant. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thanks for listening.